Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is another two-hour Zero Point Radio show through BBS Radio. It is March 20th, 2010. This show focuses on a wide range of mystical and esoteric studies, modern science, mystical psychology, paranormal phenomena, as well as discussion of the world situation and the problems of humankind. As a co-host, I have James Moffat on. Jim, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Chris?
Okay, we had a little bit of some a sample of spring and summer weather this last week.
Yeah. Is it warm in Ottawa area?
Well, it's cooled off a little bit today, but it's
nice
to have a break from the winter. And
it's been gorgeous here, too, in Toronto. It's very, very nice. Cold today, but,
yeah,
a little bit ahead of schedule. So it's odd when the sun comes out and it warms up and you get outside and just get the sunlight and get in the air, you realize there's a certain healing effect. All that is, it kind of grinds you down sometimes in the wintertime in northern climates like ours. They like to not be able to get outside and just...
Yeah, I've especially been inspired to be out in the sunlight after studying more of the secret doctrine teaching about the sun. Oh. And maybe we'll go into that a little bit today and the role of the nature of the sun, not only as illuminating the earth, like with light and heat, but also the invisible sun, what Blavatsky describes as the invisible sun, and the sun behind the sun, and the lords in the sun, and so on. Mm. It's very inspirational to have a kind of mystical view of the nature of the sun. It all makes so sense. It ties in so much to that fellow's book, John Ott, the book Health and Light, where he talked about the advantages of natural sunlight and how it affected the glands, endocrine glands, and the health. And I mean, he reported amazing results just from people getting out and getting enough natural sunlight.
Yeah.
I got a copy of that book the other day, and it said on it, over 10 million copies of that book sold.
Of Health and Light?
Yeah.
Yeah,
obviously did very well. It was a brilliant book.
Yeah.
It's almost 25, 30 years old now.
Yeah, yeah. Very interesting. He wasn't a scientist. He was a banker who had an interest in photography, and he developed the time-lapse photography, which has become a lot more common in the last 30 years. But he did a movie with the Disney studio called... On a Clear Day You Can See Forever, about Barbara Streisand played this character who was psychic and could communicate with plants. And that's how he sort of stumbled onto this. He was growing various plants and he had them in various stages because he wanted to be able to take photographs and give the illusion of multiple exposures of these plants. Give the illusion of them growing, and so he had a variety of plants at different stages and at different of growth, and different parts of them were, some of them were flowering and some of them weren't. So he was taking these multiple exposures of all these different plants and trying to create this illusion that when she sang to them, the flowers would suddenly bloom, that's when he started to encountered problems with the growth of the plants, and he sort of stumbled on to the effects of different colored filters in plastic would affect the actual growth of the plants, and he started getting more and more interested in different areas of the spectrum of the light spectrum, how they differentially affected different kinds of organisms, and he started to sort of look more and more into this in terms of his work with plants, but also started to be interested in it. Apparently it's known in breeding chinchilla that you can determine sexes by the type of quality of light, and he started doing some animal studies, and then he found out that you could actually see chloroplasts under a microscope, change their behavior, change their organization in terms of the colored filters that were in the microscope. And so he started to get, and then he had a sort of a serendipitous event when he went to Florida. He suffered from osteoarthritis, and he broke his glasses, and he was in Florida on vacation, and he was sitting outside without his glasses on for a week, and started all of a sudden feeling much, much better in terms of his arthritis, and he developed the idea that, developed the hypothesis that, that any kind of glass, like eyeglasses, sunglasses, window glass, glasses in your car, in your windshield, were filtering out parts of the spectrum of full spectrum light, and that this had negative impact on health. And he started to experiment with full spectrum lighting tubes, like fluorescent tubes that provide a full spectrum of light. Like most fluorescent lighting peaks in the red range, I believe, and his anecdotal research tends to suggest that, that fluorescent lighting is actually has very deleterious effects on human and animal health. And so he proposed that that the way to deal with this is, first of all, was for people to get outside and to get more sunlight, unfiltered by sunglasses or eyeglasses, that let it actually enter your retinas. And also to use full spectrum lighting fixtures in indoors, and he cites the example of a restaurant in which I think it was in Chicago, in which they had full spectrum lighting, and nobody ever seemed to get sick that worked there. And then I think there was a during the there was a huge flu epidemic in the 70s, and he cites the example of I think it was Orbrig Laboratories in Sarasota, Florida, had. Had installed full spectrum lighting, and while everybody else was getting sick with the flu, they had a very, very, very low absentee rate, and people reported that their moods were better, and that they found working under these lights to be a much healthier environment. So,
yeah, there's even been research showing the influence of fluorescence lights on hyperactivity.
Hyperactivity. Well, that was another
When I worked in the prison system in Ontario, at one point I persuaded them to convert the treatment unit to full-spectrum lighting.
Oh, really?
And they actually switched over in a couple dorms, and some staff, if the staff began to all want these other full-spectrum lighting. So it was interesting. We kind of changed some of the offices over to full-spectrum. And you can see the... that they're bluer relative to the red-shifted light in the fluorescence. Yeah, it's fascinating, the study of light and health. And I think there are some natural remedies for people that that have been suppressed. Like you think of Ott's work and the importance his work emphasized how natural light, how we have to have it for our health. And yet the whole push over the last years has been like to try to scare people about the near ultraviolet light, and to get people to wear heavier and heavier sunscreens, all which really, according to Ott, is like the worst thing you would want to do.
No, that's not right. That's not, I think you're getting a little bit confused. I think like ultraviolet light is dangerous, but what he was saying was that near ultraviolet was actually a positive influence. But I think the relationship between it's the far ultraviolet is cancerous and is dangerous to you, and that's kind of like that's what's so ironic is that in an effort to try to get people not to be exposed, because it is related to skin cancer and it's related to other cancers too. That's my understanding. But the irony is that you want to be outside and you want to be getting light, which is entering your eyes. Like Ott's idea was that his hypothesis was that it stimulates the endocrine system and that he thought that the pineal gland might be involved in this. But the irony is that you don't want to be out there in the noonday sun getting baked, exposing yourself, your skin to this, because it's very, very damaging. But you do want to be outside in the light, preferably in the shade, wearing sunscreen, because you do need light. I mean, that's the whole thing that with the whole flu thing is that is that one of the things is that people have depleted levels of vitamin D because they're not out in getting sunshine. We have such an indoor in the industrialized world, we have such an indoor emphasized, I don't even know what the term is for that, but you know, we spend so much time indoors that we don't get exposed to much light, especially in the winter time, and so your immune system suffers because you're not getting vitamin D. But I would argue that you're also not getting enough natural light to stimulate your endocrine system, which he claimed also stimulated the immunological system. That's why he was saying that he didn't think that. He thought that people, if they got more full spectrum light, wouldn't be as sick, and that this was directly related to health. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know
like
how much real academic research. I know there was a guy many, many years ago at the same time as Ott. There was a guy. He wasn't making the same claims, but he was certainly interested in this effect of light on health. Like I think it was Richard Workman. I remember reading this article in Scientific American about this, and he was definitely saying that people needed to get more light and more sunshine. But I don't know how much academic research. I know that there's been further books about this, but it's funny how it kind of hasn't really. But like you say, this book has sold 10 million copies, so obviously somebody's read it, you know?
Yeah. You know? And it's not something someone can copyright and own the, you know, like they don't want to tell people, you know, we're concerned about the flu season, so go out and get natural sunlight and vitamin D, you know, instead they want to put the poisons in inoculation.
No, but I mean, you could make a fortune selling full spectrum light.
You're right, actually. You're right.
I mean,
that's true.
There's a huge market for it. I don't think so much a question of suppression as I just think that everything's sort of geared towards. Everything's geared toward incandescent light and fluorescent lighting, but look what's happened in terms of the change in light bulbs. I mean, in industrialized societies where there's, you know, the people have switched over to more energy efficient light bulbs. There have been a huge switch in the whole industry in the last 5 years, you know. I mean, actually mandated in some places, like I believe in California, it's the law that have to change to these light bulbs. So,
wow.
So I mean, there's a lot of money to be made if it'd be very interesting in institutions like in schools and in mental hospitals and in regular hospitals and in prisons if people would switch to full spectrum light, it would be very, very interesting to see what kind of effects. Another anecdotal set of evidence that he had in his book about hyperactivity that I thought was very, very interesting. You know.
Yeah. Anyway, I didn't mean to get off on light too much, but I think it's so important, and that's part of what the spring is about. You get out again, and you get that sunlight.
But in a way, it really is important because it speaks kind of to what you're talking about the invisible sun in this sense. It's like, I remember when I read Ott's book, and I remember writing about it and saying, well, it's like the question, there's a famous essay about Marshall McLuhan, what if he's right? Well, what if John Ott's right? You know, I mean, the implications of what he's saying are staggering in terms of industrialized Western world, how what's happened in the last 150 years in terms, you know, people didn't used to, before the invention of use of electricity in cities, people lived in very different cycles. Like, everything's changed with artificial light, you know, with the invention of the light bulb. So if Ott's right, this has staggering implications, but it just shows you something so basic. You know, there's the sun up there and 93 million miles away, and light's coming out of there and is responsible for all organic life on Earth. And science now tells us, well, you know, the sun's just this bag of hydrogen, helium, big gas bag that, you know, emits the spectrum of light, which creates organic life on Earth. But, I mean, you know, we have a certain level of understanding of it, but we don't even really understand light. Like, that's what I think is so interesting about Ott's book. And that's just one little octave in how many octaves of radiation there are of the sun. It's some phenomenal figure. Like, there are many, many octaves. Like, we're talking about the light spectrum and the visible light spectrum, but it's much, much greater. There are numerous octaves of radiation coming out of the out of the sun. So, like, it's completely plausible that what you're talking about Blavatsky and, you know, a metaphysical sun or a subtle sun is just another level of something we don't really have a very strong understanding of. I mean, in a way, we think we do, but we don't.
Yeah, Blavatsky sees the sun as, or she sees there as being an invisible sun behind the sun. And it's like the sun is like a portal into a higher dimensional realm, with the sun behind the sun. And she says there are like seven luminous lords, like seven rays or seven gods, lords of the sun in a way, which are those spiritual intelligences whose influences propagate through the ethers within the solar system. So she sees the sun as having this kind of a dynamic zero-point center. She talks about the point within the sun, and this point is like the portal between the physical sun and the sun behind the sun. It's really quite fascinating, some of her discussion of the sun. And then she says how the spiritual sun, it lights in the psychical and spiritual levels above, like beyond physical light that we see with our eyes. And I remember someone saying on the astral plane, like even if you're turned away from the sun, that the astral light from the sun permeates, like passes right through the earth and can illuminate the astral plane and isn't obscured by the earth. So that's the idea, that there are these subtle light energies propagated through the ethers.
Well, I mean, that's very, very interesting, because it's entirely consistent with the various descriptions that people have given of transcendent or higher states of consciousness, in which sometimes people have had near-death experiences, or people have had experiences of illumination, or people have described being in their subtle bodies and being on the astral plane. And repeatedly what you get is that people always talk about this supernal light, this quality of this light, which is distinct and different from the light that we know in the physical realm. And if this exists, which its accounts suggest, it's interesting, like, where does that light come from? Eh? Like, I mean, what's the source of that light? So, I mean, that would be entirely consistent with that idea, is that there is this subtle sun, this higher dimensional sun, which is, well, it's interesting too, because she's saying that it's related to the physical sun as we know it, and that too would sort of go with the tradition in various indigenous cultures throughout history of sun worship and of the reverence for the sun. You know, it's funny how we kind of, again, we see that as being superstitious, superstitious expressions of admiration and wonder for something that we now know physically is just a physical chemical process. But perhaps these people know something much more important about the sun than industrialized Westerners know about the sun. And again,
it's a profoundly important issue, and especially you mentioned near death experiences. Like, when you consider how many people describe, like, traveling down a tunnel and then emerging into a realm of light where they encounter spiritual beings, and it's like a heaven world.
Yeah.
And if one looks around us in the world outside and says, well, where could there be such a realm of light? Well, I mean, naturally, one would say it's the sun. And then you read people like Ivanov and Blavatsky, and in their view, the sun is a spiritual world. Like, there are existing beings and intelligences in the sun, and it's a realm of existence. So the idea that a person travels down a tunnel into a realm of light, some people would say that's they're entering into the spiritual sun. And that it is a heaven world. And in a lot of the mystical traditions, it is said we come from the sun. like in Surya Yoga in India, which is Surya is the name for the sun. And one is taught that we are all sons of the sun, and we have to recover this lost identity. So in a way, the mystic aims to attain to the level of the sun. And that's the same in the Gurdjieff teaching. Like he says how we have different higher being bodies. We have a physical body, then an astral body, which Gurdjieff relates to the level of the planets and the planetary radiations propagated through the atmospheres. And then he says the mental body is a spiritual body, and that he connects to the level of the sun. And then Gurdjieff says the ultimate level in the human being is the divine body, which he relates to the level of the starry worlds. So Gurdjieff himself, in a way, sees the sun almost as a portal, like into the higher starry world beyond. And in the fourth way teaching, the aim there, Nicol says in his book that humankind on the planet is an experiment by the sun. And that we want to attain the level of the sun, which is of spiritual awakening. And that upon death we can kind of ascend and attain to the sun, or we can be, you know, in for Gurdjieff, the souls can be passed to the moon and feed the moon upon their death. And that's, Gurdjieff associates the hell worlds with the dark side of the moon at one point. So the idea is that the soul is kind of stuck between these worlds, and we can attain to the spiritual world above connected to the sun, or we can pass into the underworlds connected to the dark side of the moon. The soul is kind of caught between these worlds. It's a fascinating view that human consciousness really has this deep connection to the larger cosmos. And that's kind of what's lacking in science, I think, in modern thought, is that conception of any such possibilities like that.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's often when you read about skeptical materialists when they're talking about mystical or esoteric ideas or even ideas that they characterize as mystical, one of the common put-downs that they often articulate is the idea that these are ideas in mystical and esoteric teachings are somehow self-aggrandizing in terms of they're narcissistic in the sense that they place human beings in some sort of special place where they don't really belong, and at which science has proved that we're really nothing but higher primates. But in a way, like, what's kind of what they still miss, Gurdjieff says at one point that in Search of the Miraculous, he's talking to Uspensky, and he's talking about planetary influences on human behavior and cosmic influences, and he said only something as artificial as Western thought, which separates human beings from the cosmos, could conceivably come up with this idea somehow we're apart from nature, and we're not in any way connected with it. And I think that's the other side of it, is that in a way, these ideas they do put human beings in a special place, in the sense that they do show that there's a possibility for human beings to have fantastic potential for development and for fulfillment and self-realization. But at the same time, they just kind of show how puny we are, because we are just the small part of the grand cosmological scheme of things, and we really have. What our function or our role in all of this is, in my understanding of mystical and esoteric teachings, is that it depends on what we do in terms of our efforts to overcome our conditioning and to fulfill ourselves and to realize our possible higher states of consciousness. But in the end, it's like we could be just like the acorns that Gurdjieff talks about under the oak tree. We just dissolve and we go back into the earth and turn into fertilizer
future acorns and future oak trees. You know, the entire scheme is quite fantastic, and the possibilities are quite fantastic within it. But nothing's kind of given. Everything has to be paid for. You know, everything has to be earned. So it's like in that sense, it's not narcissistic. It's not self-aggrandizing to say that human beings have the possibility to fulfill themselves in higher levels, transcendent levels of consciousness and being. But at the same token, it's ridiculous to just suggest that all we are is nothing but like these higher primates that have no connection to the larger cosmos, or to have no purpose in the larger cosmos. I think that's
one can see how there's been a complete neglect of a science of the soul for the past century, at least in the mainstream of academia. I mean, there's always been some psychologists exploring the paranormal and psychical researchers, but those streams of investigation have kind of gone ahead quite separately. I mean, I remember like 20 years ago when 30 years ago, I became convinced that we were not simply the body, and I became convinced that there was some reality to what people were reporting from near-death experiences and other areas of paranormal studies. And I began to wonder, well, if there are all these afterlife worlds, where are these? And how does it work? How could this be possible? And that became my orientation, not to try to prove the reality of these dimensions or the non-reality of it, but rather, how could that possibly work? Like, if there are afterlife worlds, there has to be a physics of it. Like, there just has to be. There has to be a science of it. So where are these worlds, and how does it function, and how are all these things possible that we could lead such multidimensional lives? It's a shame that scientists haven't thought in that way. Like, what if we accepted the evidences of the of human experience and paranormal investigations and psychical phenomena, and tried to think out how it could work and what that means about the cosmos? And that's what we haven't attempted to do. Well, I mean, that's what I've attempted for 20 to 30 years, is try to understand those questions. And you get into the mystical studies and you begin to realize there's very complex ideas about these subtle dimensions and how it all works. It's not like there's no theories or models of it. Like someone like Gurdjieff, he has a very consistent scheme describing the levels to the cosmos and what the different bodies are and how we need to accumulate energies in these higher being bodies. I mean, in the mystical and spiritual teaching, in a way, life is about, the purpose of life is to acquire our souls, or to further our own evolution in terms of attaining to our spiritual self and attaining enlightenment. So, you know, it's this science of these possibilities has been dismissed for, you know, a century in the mainstream of Western academia and science And they tend to marginalize mystical teaching so that these became more and more divorced from science. And then scientists should try to glean insights from what the mystics say as to what that might inform us about the deeper level and meaning of the cosmos. And
I think everything you said is exactly correct. I mean, I think that's a very good description of what's wrong with modern science and psychology. And I think you know that really in a very real sense, when you describe your approach, that always struck me about what you decided to do, like 30 years ago, was to, I mean, in a way, that's a more scientific attitude, because you didn't foreclose on your assumptions about the nature of reality. You know, there's that famous quote from William James, who's generally regarded as the father of American psychology, about that our normal waking consciousness is but one special type of consciousness, and that all around us there are these other realms which, if you apply the requisite stimulus, become known to us. And it kind of concludes like something that we shouldn't foreclose in our accounts of reality in existence. Much more scientific attitude towards these things, rather than saying that, oh, there's no evidence for them, or that they're not real, which is really something that nobody can say with any conviction. The more, in keeping with the true nature of science, is like you just formulate a different set of hypotheses. Like you try to understand, well, how could this work? And what's extraordinary, what's not taught in modern education, what most people who are accomplished in science and psychology have absolutely zero clues about, is that rather than being vague and misty and unsubstantial, mystical and esoteric doctrines are anything but. They're incredibly elegant and sophisticated and complex descriptions of the nature of psychological reality and cosmological reality, and they connect the two. That's what the problem with modern science and psychology is that psychology is psychology and cosmology is cosmology, physics is physics. They're not integrated, and they don't see the connections that what the mystics have asserted throughout the ages is that there's an isomorphism that connects the levels of human potential and consciousness and the structure of the universe. And what the mystical and esoteric teachings do is provide a very convincing, at the very least, they provide an entirely plausible model of consciousness and the nature of reality, which allows one to explore these things systematically and to try to understand not only the phenomena that they're describing, but many of the most anomalous and enigmatic phenomena in modern psychology and science. And the most fundamental thing, consciousness, they provide a model of consciousness. It's so funny, like modern physics has come to the recognition that you have to understand consciousness to really be able to understand quantum theory. And modern psychology has finally come around to the idea that, hey, you know what? Consciousness is important. But everybody, when they're waxing philosophical about this, they kind of pontificate and go on about, well, what might a theory of consciousness which will represent the great step forward involve? And they have all these fanciful ideas about it, but meanwhile, there are very, very sophisticated models of consciousness that already exist in the esoteric and mystical teachings. There's no need to go out and invent one. They already exist, you know. Try to understand what these people are saying before you start making things up. And that's what really has occurred in your work, is that it's entirely consistent with modern physics and with much of modern science, and provides a way of understanding, provides a level of dialogue that's really missing in modern science between the mystical and esoteric tradition and modern science. That's what, as you say, like, I mean, it's just, when you begin to look at it, you very quickly realize that, gee, this is really something worth studying. You know, why doesn't anybody do it? And it's sort of the bankruptcy and the pseudoscientific nature of modern psychology, is that it for the longest time it denied the existence of consciousness, which is completely idiotic and absurd. But then it's defined its search for consciousness in such limited and restricted terms that what it finds is really like it's just such a small piece of the puzzle, and really doesn't address the real issues. And the most important being, I would say, is that somehow, if we have to, it's like Gurdjieff says, you know, we have to study consciousness in ourselves and we have to study the universe at the same time, and that the study of consciousness in ourselves and the study of consciousness in the universe informs the other. And that's exactly right. That's what's really, really missing, I think, in all of modern science and psychology, is that this specialized, fractionated approach to knowledge leads to these very important insights about various aspects of things, but loses the big picture and puts people in the dark about a lot of the most essential issues that confront both psychology and science.
Yeah, I remember years ago being you quoted that quote from Eddington, famous physicist Eddington, where he defined science as an attempt to like put in order the facts of experience. I forget the exact phrase.
Science is the earnest attempt to set in order the facts of experience, I think is the quote,
I realized is like there are all these facts of all these people, tens and hundreds of thousands of people reporting phenomena related to paranormal things around deaths, deathbed visions, out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, ghosts and possessions and poltergeists, all these phenomena that the whole mainstream of science has ignored for the past century, which has been the focus of mystical esoteric studies, is all these kinds of phenomena. So it's like science hasn't, they've excluded that vast domain of human experience from their data. And in a way, I think I've taken a different approach. I said, okay, well, let's grant it that what these people are saying is true. How could that work? How could it work that these things are true? Like, I remember being very impressed by Swami Prabhupada, and he was talking about, he says, oh, you people, you know, you think you're so smart, you blast off a little space capsule and you spend billions of dollars and you land a little capsule on the moon. And he says, but yogis, he says, through the science of mind control and developing yogic powers, they can travel not only to planets in the physical sky, but also to planets in the spiritual sky through the use of yogic powers. So that struck me like 30 years ago. My God, what if that were true? What if we do have such latent faculties within us? I mean, that would be astonishing. And now, I think that's very possible. I think that we indeed, as human beings, we might have higher spiritual bodies and higher being bodies, and that we might be able to travel within the solar system or into the sun or even through the sun into a higher dimensional realm. If not through our lives, then after death, that we're involved in these kinds of experiences. So it's such a profoundly alternative view of the significance of human life, whereas the past century of science has always kind of tried to persuade us that we are nothing but higher primates. There is no spirit, there is no soul, all paranormal phenomena are nonsense, you know, just illusions. Whereas if we take those things as all true, it opens up this kind of the mystery of the universe to us in a different way. And there are so many facts of human experience where people report all different kinds of psychical and mystical experiences. And the people who write about these things, they're not idiots. They're scientists, they're philosophers, they're people, you know, who introduce new religions and so on. You know, these are the explorers of human consciousness. So if we want to understand consciousness, we should try to study some of what those people who were supposed to have attained to higher levels, what they describe. We should study this. And that's what we've attempted to do through the last 30 years, is develop a science in this area.
Yeah, again, I mean, it's this sort of comes back to what we began with, too, is that when you look at anomalous experiences, the experiences that are outside the mainstream and which really cast significant doubt on the validity of mainstream psychology, you look at all sorts of transcendent experiences, you look at in terms of people having higher states of consciousness, which they've either worked to acquire or which have happened accidentally to them, or which they've had from ingesting some sort of substance, which like a hallucinogen, through a near-death experience. What you get, a recurring element of that, is this experience, the visionary experience of light. And Aldous Huxley gave a speech in the 1960s when he talked about the visionary experience and light. And he said that, you know, well, through our language, I mean, we recognize that the visionary transcendent experience involves light when we say people are illumined or illuminated or enlightened. And he says that if you look at these experiences, that people have experiences where they see, like, either objects are impregnated with this light which is shining and which it seems to be within the objects themselves, or they have like a broader kind of full blown mystical experience where everything is flooded with light and it's not only a sensory experience, but it's an experience where people apprehend that the light is an intelligence of some sort, and that they when they describe later, when they return to so-called normal consciousness, they describe this light as being intelligent, and they describe the experience of having known this light as having transformed their attitude towards their own existence. Like they see the purpose in life, they lose their fear of death. They see the essential, what he calls the essential all-rightness of the universe, and these are very powerful experiences of this light. And so, like, you know, you could kill a billion rats or a gazillion rats in scientific laboratories all over the world for the next 1,000 years, and you'll never get any closer to understanding the nature of this experience, because it can't be examined in that way. But if you read the mystical and esoteric teachings on the nature of light and on how it's possible to transform the quality of your experience, then you, by meditating, by doing yoga, by doing breathing exercises, by experimenting with diet, by experimenting with movement, then you'll find that there are methods that you can transform your experience, and you can get a deeper understanding of these experiences. And so that's just one example, like that's just one classification kind of these anomalous experiences, and one element of it, this experience of the light, which is incredibly important. I mean, you have to, if you're going to have a real psychology, you have to account for these things. This is what William James was saying 125 years ago, is that there are all these other states of consciousness. They're there, and, you know, all you have to do is apply the requisite stimulus, and sometimes it just happens spontaneously to people. Mm-hmm. And that's the other side of it, is that we all know about near-death experiences, and we all know about people trying to develop themselves and to attain higher levels of consciousness. But if you read, for instance, the work of Rainer Johnson, who wrote a book called Watcher on the Hills, he has a whole book full of experiences that happen to people spontaneously, where they had these higher states of consciousness, these transcendent states of consciousness just occur to them, and which were in many cases life altering. So what is it about these experiences? Like you say, I mean, first of all, just the sheer volume of these things, it's idiotic to deny their existence. I mean, that's just stupid. I mean, let's face it, that's moronic. Like, it's not even worth discussing. But to ignore them, if you acknowledge that they exist, is even worse in a way, because these experiences, it's not just that people have experiences, but they have these transformative experiences. Imagine if anybody could come up with a drug, or could come up with some sort of technique which would teach people that about which if people did it or took the drug would lead them to stop fearing their own death. You know, like, I mean, you could be a billionaire if you could come up with something like that. You know, like,
I think people did have some, like, experiences along those lines with LSD mescaline and peyote. I mean, those drugs have historically given people insights and experiences of this kind of multidimensional reality that has been a part of the mystical tradition.
Yeah, and it kind of
loosens the normal conditioning of the mind and conditioning and.
But what I'm suggesting is that this is an experience of light, you know.
Yeah.
That people get this from having an experience of light. So yeah, and I mean, I agree with you. That's exactly what happens with LSD and peyote and with, you know, various. I mean, there's all sorts of of ethnobiological substances throughout history that people have taken to alter their consciousness. I mean, and you know, that's the fascination of it, is that, again, that's in William James's terms, that's just the application of the requisite stimulus, which shows you
that
there's these other layers of consciousness from which we are separated, he says, by the filmiest of screens. It's just like there's this thin veneer of what we regard as normal consensual reality, but it's just like this very small band in which we live and we regard as reality, but it's not reality at all. It's just like one little aspect of reality. And so, but what I'm getting at is like, okay, that people have this experience of light and of this intelligence and what is it? Like, I mean, it should be of the utmost importance to try to understand this, but instead psychologists spend their time murdering rats and duping undergraduates in experimental procedures that are, as one psychologist famously observed, nothing more than simple demonstrations of obvious truth. Like, they don't want to study themselves. They want to manipulate things in these simplistic little 2x2 studies where you have four different outcome states, and then that's how you're going to determine reality. Like, I mean, it's everything about psychology really takes you farther and farther away from the psyche and more into just this kind of make believe, like pseudoscientific construction, which people call psychology. I mean,
it's like Uspensky said, you know, there are two psychologies. One psychology studies man as we imagine him to be, which is, and then the other psychology, he says, studies man from the viewpoint of the possibility of man's possible evolution. And then he talks about what do you mean by evolution, and he says, well, there are different levels of that we can attain as human beings. You know, we can be a man number 1, 2, or 3, which are normal types, or we can attain to these higher levels of man 4, 5, 6, and 7, which are like where people develop their higher being bodies and attain higher states of consciousness. So there's like these two psychologies, and they've remained separate through modern history. I mean, it's amazing when you think of it. You know, I've written books on two of the most important mystical books of the past century, and one is Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine, and the other is a Gurdjieff, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. And one just thinks of those profound and deep, deep books, and yet how neither of those books are taught within philosophy, psychology, education. You can barely find anywhere in North America where you could go to universities and actually study these two most important classics of the mystical literature that have been produced in the past century. And you can't even get exposed to that within the mainstream of academia.
It's
astonishing, really.
Hardly anybody that could teach them, you know, I think I've read In Search of the Miraculous probably half a dozen times, you know, which is Gurdjieff's discussions with Uspensky, and which is a different version of his teaching from that which appears in Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, but which is just as, in every way, is just as important. I mean, taken together, they're extraordinary. But like you say, nobody teaches them. Nobody who studies philosophy or psychology has a clue about this stuff. I mean, in general.
Yeah.
We were both graduate students in psychology. I never heard of these guys. I heard of them, but I had forgotten about them. They never granted any significance. I read every study in Albert Bandura's Principles of Behavior Modification and memorized them. You know, at one point I could tell you any study. It was like there must be 1,000 studies in there. But as I say, you can do another 100,000 studies along those lines, and it's really only going to show you a very little sliver of what the nature of human psychology is. I mean, that there's some validity to that work. I'm just saying that it's kind of superficial.
Yeah.
It's like when you were talking about Prabhupada, the thing I really like is in the book where he's having the discussion with Dr. Benford, I think it is.
Yeah.
And Dr. Gregory Benford, who's a physicist, and And Prabhupada says to him, you're a scientist. Yeah, and the guy says, yes. And he says, what kind? He said, well, a physicist. He said, oh, a physical scientist. So he said, you would like to study the, you study the, they're sitting on the grass, he says, so you like to study the grass and its constituents and its chemical and physical constituents. And he says, but you ignore God. And he said, well, it's not scientific. He said, but you want to study the external manifestation. You want to study the insignificant grass, but you want to ignore God. And all this is happening in God's brain, you know. And it's like, that's again, it goes to what we were speaking about earlier about, you know, you're taking little bits of things and superficial manifestations of something much deeper, much more profound, which is not as easily or readily recognizable, but doesn't mean it doesn't exist and it's not important. And that's the problem with both modern psychology and science, is that they exclusively focus on that which is externally observable and manifest, but, you know, don't want to go beyond that. Although, having said that, that's not really true, because, I mean, all of modern physics is really goes way beyond what's observable and tries to construct these symbolic representations of what they think is going on, which is really beyond the physical in a sense. Eh? Like, I mean,
I would say in a way, like, modern physics has led to metaphysics. Like,
yes. Yeah,
the
exactly.
Modern
yeah.
Physics of everyday life, like studying matter and energy within time and space, that has led them into, you know, proposing like a seven-dimensional hyperspace and, you know, models of holographic physics and things like this. So, and
recognizing the importance of consciousness. Like, I think Wigner said that you can't understand quantum mechanics without discussing consciousness, that somehow consciousness is integrally related to all this. It's just that they don't know how. And yet,
yeah,
the metaphysical models of esoteric and mystical teachings suggest how consciousness is related to this.
Yeah, it gives you important linkages. Like, I see how modern physicists, like, they now explore these ideas of hyperspace and singularities and zero-point fields, but they don't relate any of that to the studies of human existence. It's like it's a completely different area of knowledge. And like a physicist would say, like, well, how does quantum theory possibly have anything to do with consciousness? Like, they think it's a different science. It's a different, no one talks about the physics of consciousness.
Yeah.
Whereas what I would say, this is the most important contemporary issue, is the physics and metaphysics of human consciousness, you know. But anyway, I did want to, I was going to get into something a little bit. I have this most amazingly beautiful copy in front of me, Jim, of the Heart Doctrine.
Oh, yeah.
And I finally got my first book into regular trade paperback format.
Wow.
And it looks absolutely beautiful, eh? It's got a black cover, and it has that Rasuli print on the cover.
Yeah.
That print is called Veiling of the Soul.
Yeah.
And it kind of shows like seven angels, and it's a shape of a heart, and there's one angel inside and like six surrounding that angel. It's an absolutely beautiful book, and I'm just so pleased with this book. It's got over 100 illustrations in it, eh? It's just to see my work in this format is really quite thrilling. And I approved the proof last week. So this book now is going to be made available throughout North America. People can order it through Amazon. And I don't know if it's listed there yet. I only approved the proof a couple of days ago. So then they say it can take up to 2 weeks for it to be listed through Amazon. But it's absolutely a beautiful edition of my work. I'm really quite thrilled by it. So I would encourage people, order a copy of The Heart Doctrine, Mystical Views of the Origin and Nature of Human Consciousness. And it should be available, if not now, then within the next week or so through Amazon. Boy, I want to keep going with my books, Jim. You know, I've, through my life, published my books always. I've just copied them myself. myself and bound them in Sirlock bindings, and then to see my work in this format, and it's just a beautiful presentation. I'm really quite proud of this book.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you can't judge a book by its cover, but it's a nice cover. I've talked about it before on the program, but, you know, for those who haven't heard this before, but, you know, I'll say it again, and for those who have, I'll say it again. Anyway, I think it's really unique, and if you're interested in consciousness or if you're interested in psychology or if you're interested in spirituality, if you're interested in physics, if you're interested in what the possible nature of your existence might be, then you might want to pick this book up because it's an utterly unique perspective in terms of modern thinking. And there's nobody else that deals with things in the way that Christopher does. And I think that it's a really interesting and significant scholarly achievement in terms of the fact that Chris has gone through all of this through so many different esoteric and mystical traditions and extracted this common element, which is the heart doctrine, what he calls the heart doctrine, which is that the heart is the center and of the eye experience, and that the arising of consciousness occurs within the heart, and that this is related to higher dimensions of human possible existence and of cosmological existence. But this idea of the heart doctrine in and of itself is really, really interesting, and the fact that it's in so many traditions and that people don't seem to recognize it, don't seem to see how central it is to the understanding of the nature of human consciousness, is in and of itself, it's a great achievement. But then when Chris discusses the concept of the zero point, which is drawn from Blavatsky's work, and relates this to the heart doctrine and relates both human beings and any level of manifestation, world orders, human beings, to this idea of zero point origins, everything takes on a very different level of understanding. It's exactly what Chris was saying earlier about trying to understand, rather than denying these realities, trying to understand how might this work. And this is a model of consciousness, an evolving model of consciousness, which addresses essential issues and essential questions in a way that nobody else, even people who are sympathetic to esoteric and mystical teachings, has even begun to approach. And I think really is a very provocative book, and I think will probably, unfortunately, be recognized maybe after we're all long gone. I think this is a classic psychological book and one of the most important books that will come out of this era on the nature of consciousness and the nature of what it means to be human. And it's a great book. It's a very important book.
Yeah, I must say I'm just so pleased with it. And it reminds me years ago in reading Uspensky talking about the fourth way. And one in the beginning of his book called The Fourth Way, he said, if these were simply my ideas that I'm reporting, like, he said, what he is saying is that what he was reporting was not simply his ideas. And like in my book, this is not Christopher Holmes's kind of thesis about the nature of human consciousness. In a way, what makes it important is that I've discerned what the mystics are saying and I've pulled it together. Like the heart doctrine is in mystical Christianity, Judaism and Kabbalah, Sufism and Islam, the Tibetan Buddhist teachings of the Dalai Lama, and the secret doctrine of H.P. Blavatsky. It's in all these different sources. What I've simply done that's so valuable is to draw those sources together, show the commonality of these issues, like consciousness is connected to the heart, consciousness is related to light. You know, so it's what my work is so valuable is that it kind of brings these together and presents it in a way that you realize, oh, this is a serious scientific idea. It's not just metaphor, But this is a serious scientific perspective on this most profound enigma of modern times. What is the nature of human consciousness, and what is the nature of the human spirit and soul? So this book is not my ideas so much as what I've done is provide a unique synthesis that allows us, I think, to understand mystical and spiritual psychologies in a different way.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, and I think that's very important. It's like, yeah, it's not that, you know, you suddenly have this great insight into everything, you understand everything. These aren't your ideas. I mean, these ideas exist, and you know, you're a really smart guy. I'm a smart guy, but I mean, we didn't kind of invent this stuff by ourselves. This has existed for thousands of years. Like, these ideas have existed for thousands of years. What's interesting and unique, I think, about you is that you've invested 30 years of your life in studying these things and trying to understand them, and come at it from you're already a PhD in psychology when you began this, and you have more than just a grasp of the nature of modern physics, but also you worked on yourself in terms of esoteric teachings and explored these things and tried to understand yourself and tried to practice these methods for 30 years too, which is a huge part of this. It's like, this isn't sitting in an ivory tower intellectualizing about things. I mean, your work is incredibly intellectual, but it's not just the product of your intellect. It's the product of your entire being and of your efforts on a variety of fronts. And I mean, as I say, it's a great work of scholarship in the sense that, I mean, I know lots about these things, but I didn't know the heart doctrine. I hadn't read enough to understand this, and I'm not sure I would have recognized it. I think it's quite to your credit that you recognize it. And I will mention, like as I said before, other people who are even sympathetic, like I see in reading Ken Wilber's work. Now, I haven't read all of Ken Wilber's work. He's very prolific, but I've read a lot of it. And I see how he doesn't seem to see this at all. Like, he talks, I would say he subscribes to the head doctrine, and I think he's quite wrong about that on that level. And so that's, I think, if nothing else, this is an incredibly valuable contribution to trying to understand something really essential about the nature of consciousness that has escaped most people. And it's definitely an antidote to this obsessiveness with the head doctrine, this idea that all we are is our brains. I mean, you hear this repeated all of the time in both the vernacular in terms of popular discussion and in scientific circles, and it's all about the brain. And the brain is obviously pretty important and pretty interesting, but the brain is not who we are. And there are all sorts of repeated assumptions that have become common knowledge, which are, I would say, quite clearly wrong. And that is why, in part, this book is so valuable, because it questions some very basic assumptions about the nature of consciousness, which need to be questioned. And once they are questioned, I think it becomes quite obvious that what you're proposing is much more accurate and is much more important in terms of how we understand the nature of consciousness. I don't know if you're right about these things, but it's not that, it wouldn't be, if you were right, it wouldn't be that you would be right. It would be that all of these people that you're quoting are right. And as I say, I think these people are they're the Einsteins and the Newtons and the Darwins of the study of consciousness, the people who throughout history have studied themselves and realized the higher nature of their own consciousness and being. These are the geniuses of consciousness. And to distill that and then to engage in a dialogue with modern psychology and science and to integrate ideas from both to further explicate and comment on these ideas is a huge achievement, and that's basically what this work is. It's that it's a marriage of the ancient and the modern, the ancient wisdom and modern knowledge, and it leads to a really exciting synthesis and integration of ideas, which really poses very profound questions, which have important implications for us not only intellectually and spiritually, but in terms of of how we're going to live our lives and how we should live our lives and how we should educate our children and what kind of vision we have of ourselves as human beings, because these are all issues that are cast in an entirely different light when you begin to understand what Christopher's reviewing in this book and what he's proposing. So yeah, buy that book.
I think in terms of my history of study, I think what really helped me, like brought it home to me that mystical teachings were elaborating what I now call the heart doctrine, was reading the Bhagavad Gita and being exposed to Krishna consciousness. And in the Gita, and in Prabhupada's explanations of the Gita, it's so clear, Lord Krishna says, I am the self seated in the hearts of all living beings. And you, in a way, in the Gita, it's so clear, the self, the jiva atma, the individual self is connected to the heart. It's so clear in the Gita. And that's what really prompted me to say, wow, what an alternative view of what consciousness is. And then it was from the study of yogic and Vedic teachings that then led me to study in other traditions. And then I began to realize, wow, this heart doctrine, it's in Sufism, it's in, it's in all these other sources as well. But it was Prabhupada's work in the Bhagavad Gita that really helped with that. Even Prabhupada used to do that demonstration that I do when I give lectures. Get people to point to a wall and point to a window and then point to their left foot and then point to their right ear. And then I say, and point to yourself. And it's amazing. Very, very few people ever point to their heads to indicate themselves. Generally, people point towards the heart area, or sometimes more between the heart and the mind, almost to the throat. But very seldom do people point up simply to their heads to indicate themselves. It's like people have intuitive knowledge that somehow I is connected to the heart. So Prabhupada used to do that demonstration with people. And that was an example of where I thought, well, if you follow what Eddington is saying, Eddington says what we have to, science has to put in order the facts of human experience. Well, the fact of human experience is that most people point more towards their head their heart to indicate self than they point towards their head. So somehow we intuitively associate self with the heart. And people, you see it in their common expressions all the time, that somehow people know that the heart is the center. Like they'll say, let's get to the heart of the matter. Okay, whereas if you think consciousness is connected to the head, it's like speaking off the top of your head, which means that expression indicates like it's something superficial. It's kind of fraudulent intellectual knowledge. When you say, oh, speaking off the top of my head, Whereas you talk about getting to the heart of the matter, the heart of the issue, or the heart of being. And you see it even in other science writers who are kind of theistic in their writings, and yet they still use that expression, like, let's get to the heart of modern physics. There's nothing supernatural about it, they would say. But their very language, in a way, shows that kind of intuitive knowledge of the heart.
Yeah. Well, when people say that they know in their hearts, I think from reading your work, I have even deeper. It's not a metaphor. I think that that's something that's describing a reality that people have forgotten, that the heart knows, that there's a deeper level of knowing, and that it's not in your head.
Yeah. Yeah, and then one can see that in all these different mystical teachings of mystics reporting their experiences of awakening in the heart and the illumination that comes with that, and so on.
Well, it's interesting that you should say that, because I see how that's true about that. It was through your you know, your exposure to Prabhupada and his commentaries on the Gita and Krishna consciousness. And I remember at that period of time, we were living together in Maple, and that was the period when we were really getting into, Ken Wilber had brought out that book on the holographic paradigm. And,
oh, yeah.
And we were very interested in the holographic paradigm. But, I mean, in a way, the interesting aspect of that is that, as you say, like in the Gita, when it's talking about the Jiva Atma and the Paramatma, that's a holographic model. It's like,
yeah.
What is this self that is infinitesimally small point within the heart in which you know, which is yourself, but is part of the greater self and reflects the greater self, which embodies everything. So the part is in the whole, and the whole is in the part. I mean, that's a holographic model. A very profound holographic model that comes from a religious book that's, you know, thousands of years old. It's interesting how it's sort of paralleling, like on your spiritual research was congruent with your research into it. The holographic paradigm dealt with both psychology and physics, which in and of itself is really interesting, because that's kind of that separation we were talking about. The holographic paradigm suggested, well, there are basic principles that are applicable to both psychology and to cosmology, and that was sort of the profound breakthrough in that sense too. It's like, well, here's something that is recognizing that.
Like in the Bhagavad Gita, the Jiva Atma within the heart is described as self-luminous like the sun. So here was this mystical account of consciousness which actually provided a light source to possibly create the holograms of human being existence. Because, see, modern psychology was kind of developing a holographic paradigm, but no one in psychology thought there was any coherent source of light within the human being. Like, no one went there. Like, Carl Treibram even said that. He says, no one thinks there's a laser beam in the head. You know, whereas the mystics were saying, no, there's a self-luminous element within the human being, and the light of that is this consciousness that we know. So it provided a hint as to the holographic paradigm and how that didn't really develop in modern psychology, because no one got to the point of imagining that maybe there's a light, like a laser light source within the human being, a point source of consciousness within the inner world, and that creates the holographs of our lives. So when you have the insights into that from a mystical perspective, then the whole holographic paradigm takes on new significance, because there is a source of coherent light. That's what the mystics are claiming.
Yeah,
I meant to, two areas. I had another subject. Yeah, so, but just to leave that, so I would encourage people, go to Amazon, The Heart Doctrine, $24.95, the beautiful edition of it. And, two other things came up. One was, someone gave me it was mentioned by John Francis one day, when we were talking about the solar system, I was talking about the idea of the sun as having a zero point center. And I said I didn't think there was any scientists who were saying that. And John Francis wrote me an email and said, Haseem Harriman is this physicist who apparently was on Coast to Coast. And he, in fact, is claiming that there is a singularity, what he calls a white hole, black hole, within the sun.
Oh.
So he is, so here is a physicist, and he arrived at this. He was studying the impact of a comet on, I think it was planet Jupiter, and he was noticing that the red spot on Jupiter always stays in the same position, and he was kind of wondering, well, why is that always staying in the same position? And as he analyzed it, he kind of came up with the, he determined that he thinks the planets all have this kind of double torus energy field. And so he, but anyway, what his research led him to is the idea that there is a white hole, black hole, singularity inside the sun. And not only that, but he says that it generates an interior tetrahedron grid, a 64 triangle tetrahedron grid, which is like the Star of David, three-dimensional Star of David is a tetrahedron. So it's like he's actually proposing that there's this kind of tetrahedron underlying structure within the sun. And it was so amazing this last week because I was reading Blavatsky, and when she describes the lords of light, she associates with the sun, and she uses a Star of David with the central point to illustrate these, what she calls them, the Dhyan Chohan, which means the spiritual intelligences associated with the sun. So she depicts them with the Star of David with the central point. And then, so then I come across this Harriman's work, and here's someone who's actually suggesting from a scientific perspective that there is this tetrahedron grid within the interior of the sun, and it's related to its energy dynamics. So that was really quite fascinating.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah, and I'm going to research his work more.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that was one thing. And the other thing that we talked about this last week a little bit, and I wanted to come back to this. And this has to do with the alpha constant. Now, this is it's such a funny story. This alpha constant, it's one of the fundamental constants in physics. And it's quite an unusual constant. Among the constants, it's firstly, it's expressed not in units. It's a unitless, it's a ratio. And the alpha constant is the number 1 divided by 137. Now, this formula of the 1 divided by 137, in a way, that number depicts what mystics say are the fundamental principles underlying creation. Because the idea above on the numerator of the fraction, you have 1. Well, that 1 represents the deity or that or the absolute, like undivided. Okay, and then below in the denominator you have 137. So it's like that infinite being, the 1, gives birth to a 1, meaning the sun, and that sun has a triune and then sevenfold nature. So in a way, this formula of 1 divided by 137 is actually, that formula is what's suggested by the secret doctrine of H.P. Blavatsky. And it's suggested by the Gurdjieff teaching. That the one, God is first 1, then 3, then 7. So that number, 1 divided by 137, has profound mystical, occult, metaphysical significance. And then you find, by coincidence, that this is the alpha constant. And alpha means the first number, the first letter. It's the alpha constant. And it, what's amazing about it, the alpha constant is really equal to the charge of an electron divided by Planck's constant times the speed of light. And so the alpha constant really has the charge on the electron is the major unit of electromagnetism and electrical charge. The speed of light is a fundamental constant in physics, and then Planck's constant is a measure of discreteness in quantum interactions. So in the alpha constant, you have a proportion relating the charge of an electron, the speed of light, and the Planck's constant, and you put those in relationship to each other, and it comes out to this number, 1/137. And that's this fundamental constant of nature. Okay. And I just think of how ironic is that, Jim, like I'm writing about intelligent design, how about the law of 3 and 7 are fundamental to the universe, and then it turns out that the fundamental constant of physics, which relates quantum theory and relativity theory, and the formula of it, alpha, is 1/137, which is the same number that one could arrive at from the study of the secret doctrine and the Gurdjieff teaching and Kabbalah. It's embodied in all of those teachings.
Just a coincidence.
Yeah, I mean, that's so funny. I mean, that's what scientists would say. Oh, it's just a coincidence. And then what's so funny about this alpha constant, I went on the YouTube and I watched a few videos of it, and one of them was a physicist. He says all physicists have long been fascinated by this constant and its significance because like a dimensionless number. And he says whenever you ask of, you know, if you knew the physicists' passwords for their bank accounts and things like that, they all probably use 137. Like he said, that would be the best place to start, you know. I know, it's in my numbers, but anyway. What's also so funny about this number, the constant 1/137, is this account of Pauli, the great physicist Pauli, and his fascination with this alpha constant. And towards the end of his life, he was admitted at one point to a hospital room numbered 137.
Yeah.
And apparently this is reported by David Peet in his book called Synchronicity. And he talks about Pauli and Jung. And when Pauli went into that room and the number on the room was 137, Pauli thought that had immense significance and it foreshadowed his death. Sorry?
He did die.
Yeah, he did die.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he knew it when he got room 137. Yeah.
Got 138.
Yeah.
I want to be moved now. Yeah, I know.
So here is this number, and there's all these kind of historic synchronicities around the significance of this fine surface constant. And it's this profound number. I mean, what is the likelihood that the first fundamental constant of physics, and it's the only one that's not expressed in units, like it's not ergs or it's not meters per second or anything like that. It's a dimensionless number, and it relates to relative strength of quantum and relativity effects. Like, so it's this kind of fundamental number built into the structure of the universe, and it's 1/137. I'm still stunned by that, and I'm trying to understand and study what this fine structure constant is in physics. Because it's hard to know exactly the meaning to give to it.
Well,
like in one book I just read, the fellow said one of its implications of it is, he said, one out of every 137 electrons emits a photon. So it has something to do with the relative strength or something of the emissions of light by photons.
Really?
Yeah, that's one interpretation. But I mean, I've seen other, I have another chart where they're showing the relative strength of the electromagnetic force to the strong force in physics. And that ratio is 1/137.
Yeah, I think I've heard that before.
Yeah.
You know, too, we've talked about that if you, you know, in the Hebrew alphabet, everything has numerical values. If you add up the value of Kabbalah, it's 137, eh?
Yeah, actually I came across an article that reported that. It was this famous Kabbalist scholar talking to a physicist, and the physicist recounted this fine surface constant. And the Kabbalist said, yeah, that's the number of the Kabbalah. Yeah, it's astonishing. I mean, what a remarkable coincidence.
Yeah.
I've just finished this book I've been reading. It's called Cosmic Landscape, String Theory and the Illusion of Intelligent Design.
Oh, okay.
And it's by a string theorist, physicist, and like what he tries to approach in the book is like a lot of people say that the constants in nature are so finely attuned that if the constants had been any different, life never would have arisen.
Yeah.
So a lot of people who believe in intelligent design say, well, this points to there being intelligent design behind the design of the universe. And this physicist is arguing the anthropic principle, which he's saying, well, you know, we exist, the universe has to give rise to us if we question its existence. What am I trying to get at? Well, the main point in his book is that he's saying there are so many different possible landscapes in string theory of how these parameters of nature could take on this huge number of possible values in what he calls a landscape. And he's saying there are so many possible values that that's why that one of them happened by chance to give rise to life.
Yeah,
so,
I think what you're trying to say is that if the fact that we're here to understand them is an indication that's part of the reason why it is so finely tuned is that we're here to observe it. Like isn't that the idea? Isn't that the argument? Is that human beings wouldn't be here to observe how finely tuned everything was if it wasn't finely tuned? Like it's part of the fulfillment of that fine tuning. But
and the way he's using string theory is to say that what string theory does, it gives you so many. It's 10^500. Unbelievable number of possible vacuum states and values for the constants of nature. He's generating this huge population of possible universes in order to account for the fact that we happen to be in one where it worked.
Yeah, but even that, like, I get that idea that the multiverses, and I mean,
that's right.
It's probably even true on some level, but even that, like, when you look at the fine tuning constants, it's so ridiculously improbable. And even, it's not just the universe, it's biologically human beings. Like, you know, it's so immensely complex. Like the numbers are so staggering that if you add them all together, it's beyond chance in any. Well, I don't know if it's beyond chance if you have all these, you know, these staggering number of possibilities. But intuitively, I just think that's not a good argument. I think it's actually really. It's kind of grasping at straws. Like, well, let's put it this way. What would be the more parsimonious explanation? You know, I think it's to say that there is intelligence behind the manifest universe
existence.
I think that's really not a good argument. Well, it's plausible, but I just don't think it's right. I think it's wrong, you know, I really question that whole approach. I just think that's really grasping at straws. I mean, and, you know, there's one other small problem, you know, is that throughout history, there have all been all sorts of human beings who have had other knowledge of higher intelligence, the direct knowledge, which suggests that there is higher intelligences guiding us and informing the cosmos and informing the material plane. So that's, you know, I mean, that's
yeah, no, I totally didn't agree with this argument.
No, I realize that, but I'm trying to even like consider it even just scientifically, like, you know, just within the realm of science. It strikes me as being wrong. even with those staggering numbers, like my understanding of the cosmological constants, but it's not just cosmology. It's like within human beings too. There's this whole other ridiculous number of implausible numbers applying to the coherence of the physical body and biological life, which is so ridiculously out there that I just don't see how anybody can see this as all being random. To me, that just is illogical. Like, I just don't get it.
Yeah, no, it's like a new generation of arguments for randomness in nature. But
yeah.
Now he's kind of trying to base it in science by saying there are so many possible states of string theory, vacuum, and vacuum states. Yeah, no, it's not
observational too. I mean, string theory is. I mean, it's all an extrapolation from observation. So in and of itself, string theory is a construct which may or may not be wrong. There's all sorts of problems with string theory too. You're using one hypothetical to generate another hypothetical, which is to try to explain a reality, which, to me, like, as I say, it just seems to me to be I'm not sure what the word I'm trying to, it just seems, it's implausible to me, but it's more than that. It's some sort of intellectual gambit which is not really... it's not parsimonious. It's like, yeah, if you apply Occam's razor, it just doesn't seem to be parsimonious. It just seems to be, it's like one of those Rube Goldberg contraptions which you have to keep adding things on to keep everything together, you know. It just doesn't wash in my books, but, you know, what do I know? You know, I don't know.
Yeah, well, no, I absolutely...
I don't know how the toaster works, so, you know.
It's just trying to dress up, you've had all these scientists for years saying how, you know, all of evolution is random and accidental and random genetic changes and this randomness and is so pervasive in modern physics. And it's like the alternative is to intelligent design, is to see it as due to random. So it's just a more sophisticated perspective on the same issue, and it doesn't give you, it's not falsifiable, like,
well,
it doesn't meet the criterion of a scientific theory, like,
yeah.
It's non-falsifiable.
Yeah, I mean, that reminds me too, is that in Uncommon Wisdom, Fritjof Capra's book, he has conversations with the various people, famous people, a very interesting book, and at one point he became friendly with Heisenberg towards the end of his life, and Capra's Austrian and Heisenberg was German. And I guess when he was conversing with him and in his home, in I think it's Capra's home, or no, maybe it was Heisenberg's home, but anyway, whatever, Capra noticed that Jacques Monod's book was Chance and Necessity. Heisenberg had a copy of it, and he was interested in hearing what Heisenberg had to say about it. And like, Monod is the French, he won the Nobel Prize in biology, French biologist, and he was one of the figures in the 60s and 70s who said that everything in modern science essentially shows that we live in this vast, cold universe that's indifferent to our fate, blah, blah, blah. You know what, Joe, we're just here, the result of random, accidental processes, you know, preserved by natural selection. The whole kind of standard materialist camp that everything is accidental and random and purposeless, and that's a big one with Monod, is all, there's no purpose to any of it. And so Capra asked Heisenberg what he thought of it, and he said, well, you know, when he's talking about the biological science, it's good science, but when he's speculating what it all means, it's bad metaphysics, you know, and he was totally unimpressed by it and didn't believe it at all. I mean, which is kind of ironic insofar as Heisenberg, you know, is the formulator of the uncertainty principle about the limits of what you can stipulate in physical science. But that's it too, is that, you know, there were lots of famous scientists, many famous scientists, who don't subscribe to this whole, you know, this whole idea that everything is, that science has just established that everything's random and purposeless and it really is nothing more than the fortunate outcome of a variety of blind circumstances and accidental happenings that have created everything. But I mean, that's not science. That's an interpretation. You know, Steven Weinberg's famous for saying that, you know, the more that we look at the universe, the more it seems like we're, I think, what's his phrase, that we're accidental intruders or something, that it's indifferent to our fate or something like that?
Yeah, a long chain of accidents or something like that.
Yeah. And yet, you know, like, I mean, you have to be very careful when you're repeating that or when you're arguing that, because really that's a very loaded interpretation. It's not given by the science, and it's ridiculous. It points to the problem we were talking about earlier a little bit. It's based on a consideration of certain areas of science, which are based on certain approaches to studying things, which yield certain results, but they're not comprehensive, all of these bodies of knowledge and all of these findings are based on certain assumptions about things, which deny essential aspects of reality. So to conclude that science has established this and that this, you know, these interpretations are reasonable is really, you're really going out on a limb if you're going to stake yourself to that. I mean, that's the problem with Richard Dawkins and Carl Sagan and all these people who argue that really, you know, we're nothing more than higher primates with no purpose, and that we're accidental results of random processes preserved by natural selection and random mutations. It's, you know, that it's a pretty speech, but it's really not based on a comprehensive, I would say, understanding of even science, and there's so much more beyond science which contradicts that. So
yeah, it's a philosophical leap of faith on their behalf, it's presented as though it's science, as though it's based in science, where it's not presented as this is my philosophical leap of faith.
Yeah, it's like that quote that you use often that I think it was in Psychology Today that, from Sagan, where he says, you know, there's no soul, there's nothing, nothing, you know, beyond the 10 to the 28th or whatever it is synapses in our brain, that's all we are.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, how does he know that?
you know,
I mean, and at another place in his work, he says that in the cosmos, he says that, you know, that consciousness emerges out of the cerebral cortex and the architecture and I mean there's zero evidence for that, like there just isn't.
Yeah.
You know what,
and when you go to the real science like of Wilder Penfield, the very famous Canadian neurosurgeon who stimulated parts of people's brains while they were awake and had them report on their experiences, He came to the exact opposite conclusion back in the 1960s. He said there's no possible way for the cortex to explain the phenomena of mind or consciousness. So there, you know, and then, you know, 20 years later, I mean, Sagan in his book, Cosmos, he says the cerebral cortex produces human consciousness, but there's not one iota of evidence for it, or any definition of consciousness, or how the cortex produces it. I mean, it's presented as though it's science. Really, it's pseudoscience.
Yeah.
A lot of the philosophy underlying modern science, I would say, is pseudoscientific in that way.
Well, the materialist, the reductionist position that people like Sagan and Dawkins, for instance, subscribe to, in writing about the problem of God's contracting universe, I point out that, you know, I've read all of Sagan's books, but I've read most of them, and I've read most of them several times. And one thing that really strikes me is that about reading him is you know, he really doesn't have any meaningful discussion of what happened in 20th century physics in terms of the philosophical implications. It's like there's no discussion in his work of, say, for instance, the, you know, Eddington's observation that, that you know, what we are is mind stuff, or that, you know, that James Jeans' observation that the more we study it, the more the universe looks like a great thought than it does a great machine. And you know,
yeah.
These are profoundly important statements based on, you know, these are very accomplished physicists who have tried to penetrate to the heart of matter and have found that there is no essential building block, and that really there's something going on here beyond the actual physical constituents and their organization, that there's some sort of information or consciousness which plays an integral role in the structure of a physical reality. And yet you can read Sagan and, you know, and Dawkins and never even get any idea that these ideas exist, and that these are important ideas. And
yeah,
and
or these enigmas, like,
yeah, or, you know, like, you get, you know, a guy like David Bohm, his work, like, you know, on hidden variables in quantum mechanics and in relativity theory. And, you know, what he's trying to do is to say, what is it that both systems are deal with different parameters of physical reality, but what they both point to is somehow some sort of unity. And what he's trying to do is to extrapolate from that and say, well, what are the potential hidden variables? What would make sense to account for these findings and to somehow reconcile what seemed to be irreconcilable differences between the two approaches? And that's when he got into the whole idea of his holographic model of reality. And again, like, you know, you'd never find anything like that in Sagan's work, but that this is a very profound development in modern physics. And then, you know, the whole importance now placed on information in modern physical theory, you know, again, doesn't that sort of suggest to you or that there's some sort of intelligence behind this physical reality, that somehow it's not all just this blind, uncoordinated, you know, happenstance and circumstance and random processes. I mean, I mean, the whole idea is observed in that level that it's all random. I mean, it isn't random. There's certainly a level of randomness in every realm of reality, I think. I mean, I think that's part of it, but there's also an order and a coherence which goes far beyond anything we could imagine, which on some level bespeaks of an intelligence which is behind everything. I think I don't understand how people can study science and say, oh, it's nothing more than, you know, and just stick to the physical observable elements of things. I don't get that.
Yeah, and we've been, modern education has been dominated by that superficial materialist philosophy the past century, and that's why they've had to discount all evidences for paranormal phenomenon, all these enigmas, because we have no way to incorporate that into the main philosophical basis of modern science. So
yeah, exactly. And I mean, one of the areas where, you know, it's kind of ironic, but it's a development that happened in modern medicine, which is directly, you know, produced by that school of thought. In a sense, it's like it's a product of the cardiac resuscitation technology has led to a much better understanding of the near-death experience. And really, when you look at the near-death experience and you look at the history, I don't know it in detail, but I know enough of it to realize that when you look at the people who've really looked into this and studied this carefully, even those who began as skeptics about it, quickly are disabused of the notion that, oh, you know, people are anoxic and they're having these unusual experiences, that there is no physical explanation which in any way can account for this. There's something much, much deeper going on, and I think that's actually one of the areas which I think that the evidence is so overwhelming there that it really it represents a challenge to the entire materialist assumptive framework. something completely different is going on in human consciousness when people have these near-death experiences and have these common elements in their experiences and come back and have these transformative experiences. You know, one of the things I was really interested in, I was reading this guy, I can't think of his name right off the bat, but it's about near-death experiences. And one of the elements that I didn't realize is that some people who have these near-death experiences not only have a life review, which is, you know, in itself really fascinating, but one of the things that really jumped out at me was when they have the life review, they're not only aware of their own reactions and their own actions, but they're aware of their effects on other people.
Yeah.
Now that, in terms of holographic theory, I think is really, really, you know, really fascinating and really suggestive that perhaps on some level that, you know, we have interactive holograms with other people that we know, and that somehow when we have these near-death experiences, the information is collapsed so that people have access to not only their own experiences but others' experiences. I mean, I'm just sort of, I don't know, talking off the top of my head, maybe not from the heart. But, you know, like, I mean, I just thought that was really fascinating that people would, it was David Lorimer's book, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Wholeness.
Yeah, they not only recall the events of their life, but also they are aware of the karmic, of how their actions affected other people.
Yeah, exactly.
So somehow they had access to the kind of quantum field information of other people's lives.
Well, that's a better way of saying it. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, again, as I say, how you would possibly, I mean, even if people were anoxic and were having these experiences, still wouldn't really deal with them. Like, that the experience is more important than the physiological correlates, I would say. Like, I mean, the experience in and of itself is what's really important, because the experiences aren't random. They feature certain distinct elements that recur repeatedly and which really demand some sort of explanation. So it's even if you were able to say, oh, well, here's what's going on physiologically, that wouldn't really begin to explain the experience, which is the important part.
Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting. I saw a little video on YouTube, and I'm not sure if it was Michel Sabon who did that, or who was one of those skeptical doctors who investigated near-death experiences, and he became convinced of their reality. But in this a YouTube clip, it was a report on this experience where this person's heart was completely stopped during an operation, and the heart was completely stopped, and all they put this person, like, lowered the temperature so it didn't cause brain damage, and when this person recovered from their operation, they reported out of body experiences and so on that had some evidence for it, and it was like there's no possible explanation, because this person, there was no cortical activity, like there was no way you could attribute their experience to like anoxia in the brain or epileptic discharges, anything like that. So the person's actually, the heart had been stopped and there was no cortical activity, and they came back and reported evidential material from claiming they had had out of body experiences. but anyway, it just shows how modern science has this kind of presumption that we live in only a material universe, and there is no spirit or soul life to the universe or to ourselves. And really, it's all been based on assumption, but it's presented as though it's scientific fact, and there's been this kind of dismissive attitude towards all those evidences that show there's something more to human life than simply being biological organisms. And that's where we began 30 years ago, when I realized, oh, you know, there's something here. We have to account for this. We need some other model of the nature of human existence. So anyway, so it's been a fascinating 30-some years of studying the esoteric traditions, and I'm so pleased to have produced this Heart Doctrine book. And I hope to get the next one, God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. I hope to have it ready by the end of April. I'm going to try to get both of these in shape before I really begin to try to promote them and get word of them out there and send copies off and so on. So I would encourage people, go to Amazon.com and have a look for The Heart Doctrine. And it's a beautifully presented book and a profound book. And I'm very proud to be the author of that. It's kind of like if I had nothing else of my work published in my life, I'm thrilled to have had this published. And I realized, Jim, we gotta keep publishing our materials along this line. You gotta get alien intelligence on Gurdjieff. You gotta get it. You know, if you can't find a publisher, when you see this book, you know, let's get it in this form and publish it ourselves.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to do that. I was working a little bit, just looking at it the other day, and I was like, I really have to get that book out there, because I, you know, there aren't that many. Well, actually, I think it's an interesting interpretation of Gurdjieff. I mean, I think I have something a little bit different to say about him than most people do. So,
both of us do. We have some quite unique perspectives on the Gurdjieff teaching,
and relating
it to modern science and psychology and life experience.
And I in terms of your own work, I think it's odd because as you said earlier in the program, you know, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson is one of the most profound books ever written and one of the great spiritual classics, and yet there's very, very few people who can comment on it intelligently, and there's a real paucity of any intelligent writing on it. There just is very little. There's Bennett's book, and I know that there's a woman who wrote her doctoral thesis on it. That was in the Gurdjieff International Review. I read about this a couple of years ago. But your book, The Slugs, is very, very interesting and very informed perspective, and I really hope you can put that out too there too, because I think that's a really, really good book, as is your book, Man's Psychological Illusions. Probably the most comprehensive psychological assessment of Gurdjieff, I think. I think there's no book that's as detailed as Man's Psychological Illusions. Very, very, or I guess it's just Psychological Illusions now, eh? But it's a very, very good book. You should.
I know I want to expand The Slugs because I want to go into other aspects of the Beelzebub's tales, like some of the things Gurdjieff says about our history and how it strikes me now how the whole setting of that story is so unusual, how he has an observatory on the planet Mars. And now there's evidence is coming out that some people believe there are observatories and things, structures on Mars. And so a lot of aspects of Beelzebub's tales, which previously I thought were only metaphorical, now I'm beginning to really wonder about other elements in that. Because he even talks in that book how they come and they breathe with beings on planet Earth and they interblend with us and so on. I'm wondering about that there's more hidden history to that book than previously I'd realized. But anyway, I notice we're coming, we've just got a minute or two here left. Thanks, Jim. So we'll be back in 2 weeks' time. I'm not opening Zero Point tomorrow. I'm glad I've kind of delayed it a little bit. I've ordered 100 copies of my book, so I'm going to have a good stock of books next week. They'll be in.
Yeah, great.
So I'm quite excited about that.
Yeah.
So thanks, Jim. I will be back in 2 weeks. Thank BBS Radio.
Yeah.
And this is Jim Moffitt and Christopher Holmes. Zero Point Radio. Please visit my website at zeropoint.ca. I have a wealth of writings up there, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. Remember yourself, keep heart, and we as human beings, we are multidimensional beings, and there's profound mysteries to human existence that science, unfortunately, has not begun to understand. Thank you all. Goodbye.
Thanks, Ken.